On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 40 years ago this summer, Chinese Communist Chairman Mao Zedong launched the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, unleashing a painful decade of torture, humiliation, prison, and exile in China. In the 1980s, Deng Xiaoping healed the wounds with market liberalization and the seeds of China's comeback. Now, a booming new China, still under Communist Party rule, contemplates its political future. And the beacon in some quarters is a very old one. Not Mao or Deng, but Confucius, the great sage of antiquity. Democracy advocates worry that is a path to authoritarian trouble. Confucians say it's the Asian way. Up next on Point, Confucius and the hope of democracy in booming China. First today, we turn to China for a quick update on the current political climate. Hannah Beach is Shanghai bureau chief for Time magazine. She joins us from Shanghai. Hannah, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Give us just a primer here. Here we are, summer 2006, 40 years after the Cultural Revolution. Where does power lie in China? Is it still all in the hands of the Communist Party? Are there elections? Are there even inklings of democracy there?
Well, it's interesting, Tom. I think if you ask the average Chinese what they think about democracy, there's often a suspicion of the concept. Chinese tend to think of democracy as messy. And, you know, when you're a crowded country with 1.3 billion people, you don't necessarily like messiness. But if you break down this grand concept of democracy and ask people, look, do you want freedom of the media? Do you want to be able to get rid of corrupt leaders? Do you want checks and balances in the political system? Chinese tend to be enthusiastic about these issues. So they may not think they like democracy per se, but they certainly like its building blocks.
And what about the Communist Party, which is in charge? Do they see any democracy in China's future or a particular brand that they might define?
It's interesting. I think the Communist Party as a whole is not particularly in favor of democracy, certainly. There are some idealistic intellectuals within the party who are quite quiet, who do see it as a positive concept. I think the question is less what the Communist Party thinks. I think the question is more what do the Chinese themselves want. And what's interesting to me is that if you ask the average urban middle-class Chinese, you know, do they like democracy, they don't necessarily think it's a great thing. What they've seen is that in the last 20 years, they've gotten very wealthy very quickly through this weird sort of communism-capitalism hybrid that China's perfected. They don't see the upside to democracy in the way that we might.
So the presumption has often been in the United States that with affluence, with economic development, comes political liberalization. You're saying you don't see that developing in China? Does that mean stability? You know, for decades here, we hear about all kinds of tensions in Chinese society.
Certainly. There are many answers to that question. I think, first of all, the middle class so far hasn't seen anything that has really impacted their future. If China's corruption, which is a significant force, gets worse, if the middle class feels like their economic livelihood is being threatened by a government that can't be held accountable for their actions, I think their attitudes toward democracy are going to change. And if you look in the countryside in China today, there are a lot of protests going on. I think last year, by the central government's own account, there were 87,000 public order disturbances. In 1994, for comparison, there were only about 10,000. So, you know, that's a sea change. There are protests going on. But the question is, you have a lot of farmers who are angry in the countryside. They're angry about environmental degradation. They're angry about their land being taken away without proper compensation. They're angry about corrupt local leaders. But this hasn't really gelled into a cohesive nationwide movement. You have these isolated flare-ups. Until they can gain national cohesion, then the Communist Party doesn't have that large of a problem.
And in urban areas, are there protests there? Is it possible to raise a public protest of any kind? Or are urban Chinese more or less happy with their economic development and not worried about the rest?
Well, that's certainly what the Communist Party wants you to think. Certainly, there are protests in the urban areas as well, particularly dealing with land issues. A lot of people who live in the centers of towns like Beijing and Shanghai have had their land taken away without fair compensation or what they think is fair compensation. There are, as I said before, isolated protests, But unless you have something bringing these people together, right now, you know, how do you tie an angry farmer in northwestern China to an angry middle-class yuppie in Shanghai? It's very difficult to find something that brings them together. And so far there hasn't been a charismatic leader of the Chairman Mao variety to bring people together.
Hannah, you've been there for years now. Just personally, can you picture a democratic China evolving from the history of the last 100 years, the last 2,000 years? Do you see a democratic China in the future or not?
It depends on which day you ask me. You know, I think a lot of Chinese posit democracy as a Western concept. I don't think that's the case. I think democracy is a human concept, and if that's the case, then China certainly can have a democratic future.
Hannah Beach with Time Magazine in Shanghai. Hannah, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Joining me now from Montreal is Professor of Political Philosophy and Ethics Daniel Bell. He's been living and teaching at Tsinghua University in Beijing for 2 years now and was in Hong Kong teaching for 8 years before that. His new book is Beyond Liberal Democracy, Political Thinking for an East Asian Context. Daniel Bell, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Confucius stands way back there. I don't know who you would look to as a kind of a parallel in Western culture, someone as grand as Aristotle. Does that history mean China can have democracy, cannot have democracy, may be on a path to its own style? Would we recognize it?
Well, I think the question should be every political system needs a moral foundation. And now the moral foundation officially is Marxism. But I think Marxism doesn't have much legitimacy anymore, even among government officials. So the question is, what should be the moral foundation of the government? If not now, in 20 years, I mean, I think everybody expects substantial change in China. The political system in 20 years, certainly in 50 years, won't look at all like it is now. So the question, what should it be? Should China just look to Western countries for inspiration? Or should they look to their own tradition for inspiration? And I think more and more now, there's growing sense of cultural pride in China and a greater tendency to look to its own sources for inspiration. So I think this is where Confucius comes in, because Confucianism is the main political tradition in Chinese history. So I think there's a sort of psychological reason to look for Confucianism. But I think there's also, I mean, I'm a political philosopher, I'm a normative thinker, and I think there's also good normative reasons to look for Confucianism, because I think much of what Confucianism says, especially early Confucianism about 2,500 years ago, is actually quite modern and relevant for and desirable for the modern political system. So I think
remind us who Confucius was, his stature in Chinese culture, and the basic precepts of his teaching, his philosophy.
Okay, well, Confucianism is a long tradition, and it's been combined with other traditions, Taoism, legalism, and liberalism more recently. So it's a long and diverse tradition. So, but I think the two most influential founding figures are Confucius and Mencius, who came about 100 years later. And basically, they were in their own day, they were very much critics of the political systems in which they existed. And both of them, they went from, in those days, China wasn't unified. It was called the Warring States period. And they went from country to country trying to persuade political leaders to adopt their ideas, which didn't really work in their own day. But it worked subsequently in Chinese history. So what are their main ideas? One is that the importance of the quality of political rulers, that the political rulers have to be the most capable and the most public-spirited members of the political community. And two is the emphasis on material well-being, that the most important task of government is to provide for the material well-being of the people. And three is very much the emphasis on family ethics, that the family is the key to the good life, and any sort of decent government will try to ensure that the family flourishes in society. I think all those ideas are quite modern.
Quality leaders, everybody would like to have quality leaders, but depends who's deciding who's quality leaders. Do you see democracy, as Americans would recognize it, possible from that Confucian seedbed?
Well, the problem with democracy is that the main mechanism for choosing political leaders is elections, and elections doesn't necessarily produce the most capable political leaders. I mean, often people need to resort to emotions and demagoguery and so on to get elected. So in Chinese history, how did they choose political leaders? I mean, historically, they relied on the examination system. There were many defects, but overall it was administered in a fair and meritocratic way. And
so you take a test to see who would be the leader.
Right. And there's many intellectuals in China now who are looking to that as a way of reviving Confucianism, having some sort of examinations to choose political leaders. So it would be different than the political system now where loyalty to the Communist Party is the main way of choosing political leaders. It would be to have fair and meritocratic examinations as a way of choosing political leaders. But that's not necessarily incompatible with democracy. I mean, some of the proposals that have been made, for example, in my book, I discuss one idea, which is inspired by Confucianism, where the lower house of government would be democratic, where deputies are chosen by elections,
mm-hmm.
and the upper house, the deputies are chosen by examination. So you can have a combination of a kind of Confucian house and democratic house.
Daniel Bell, I'm looking here at the transcript of an interview with China's then president Jiang Zemin in 2000. He was talking with CBS's Mike Wallace. Mike's been busy talking with Ahmadinejad this week, but then it was the Chinese leader. And Jiang Zemin said to Wallace that the Chinese people can't be allowed to have universal suffrage at this time, he said, because this is quoting the Chinese leader, the quality of our people is too low. If they were given the right to choose the government, chaos will ensue. Is that a Confucian perspective? And does it promise democracy at all?
Well, I think Confucian's, the general view is that it's only going to be a minority of people who have sufficient time to devote themselves to study, which is the key to really developing the kind of capability and public spiritedness that political leaders should have. So in that sense, I think it is a view. I think there's also an implicit view in Confucianism that not everybody has the talent to be a political leader. Having said that, I mean, so I think Confucians are skeptical about the idea of politics by the people. But the idea of politics for the people, that's very much a Confucian view. I mean, the moral purpose of government is to secure the people's interests. And the political leaders' interests come last, really, in the Confucian moral framework. So the question is, how do we choose the political leaders that have the interest, the capability of serving the people's interest, basically? And I think in that sense, if that's what Jiang Zemin meant, I think it's a Confucian view. But I think the problem, and it's true that the current government now is officially promoting Confucianism. You may know that they have Confucian institutes in around 20 different countries to promote Confucian values and the Chinese language. But what the government calls Confucianism is very different, I think, from what from what the moral foundations of Confucianism should be.
But isn't that the dilemma here? I mean, in the Western tradition, or at least the American tradition, the fact of government by the people is what is supposed to guarantee the government for the people. If it's not by the people, if a communist party can just take that Confucian tradition and claim it as its own, what's the guarantee that it actually works for the people?
Well, I mean, it could be that the Communist Party is misinterpreting Confucianism just as they misinterpreted Marxism. And for Marx, it's quite clear that you have to go through capitalism before you move on to communism. So the Communist Party distorts Confucianism because they don't as I said, the most important thing about Confucianism is you have to have a fair system for choosing the best leaders. And now the way the system is, the main criterion is loyalty to the party. That's not a Confucian view. The Confucian view is you have a system that allows for the best leaders to be chosen. And the political status quo in China doesn't do that. And I think Confucians would think that pure electoral democracy doesn't do that. So then we need to think about other possibilities. And again, this is where the free and fair examination process is one that's widely discussed. And it doesn't have to be all Confucian or all democratic. As mentioned, you can have one house of government, which is democratic, and one which is Confucian. And then we need to think about the balance of powers between those two houses.
Little Singapore, led for years by Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew, has made the case for a long time, at least Lee has, that
Western-style democracy is incompatible with Confucianism. I want to bring a Chinese voice into this conversation. We're joined from Berkeley, California, by Xiao Cheng. He's director of the Berkeley China Internet Project at UC Berkeley School of Journalism, former executive director of Human Rights in China, vice chair of the steering committee of the World Movement for Democracy. He was exiled as a student activist from China following the Tiananmen massacre in 1989. Xiao Cheng, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Do you see a revival of Confucian thinking in China, and do you see that as compatible with democratic evolution, as a limiting factor on democratic evolution?
Well, the answer to your later question is both. I do see the rise of this intellectual investigation and searching for, as Professor Bell said, the moral foundation for future political system. And it is clear the current political institutions are not compatible for a sustainable development of China, and the Chinese Communist Party is essentially ideologically bankrupt. So in this case, as Professor Daniel Bell said, what's the inspiration for the future political system? I think his book and his research presenting some very important search in this area. But as a Chinese, particularly as a Chinese political activist mm-hmm. and living in exile, I want to bring 2 points to this discussion. Mm-hmm. One is simply is the politics is about power. You as a host, Tom, that just by instinct asking the street question like, oh, quality of rulers, who decides, right? Mm-hmm. Politics for the people, how can you guarantee that? I mean, that's so basic for Americans because you know you cannot rely on someone, no matter what education degree it is, or how many books he reads or mm-hmm. she reads, mm-hmm. can claim he's for the people. And look at Chinese Communist Party. It claims for all the people, or all the interest. But let's just look at what have done in the last 20 years. In terms, it's a very impressive economic development.
Yes.
People are very appraised to it. But on the other hand, they completely dropped the rural the peasants, the workers in the state-run enterprises. Those people, they claim they represent, but in their real policy, they don't. They became the victims of those new development economic policies. So there's a huge gap.
So
I'm not questioning the economic policy per se. I'm questioning this fundamental gap between what they claim they are and what they actually do. And this is a crisis in China now.
So as a democracy activist, when you hear of Chinese looking back to Confucius, and I don't claim to be a scholar here, but sort of my rough understanding is that that's a fairly hierarchical view of the world. Not hard to turn it to a kind of authoritarian rule, but do you see promise in that, or do you see a problem for democratic evolution?
I see very questionable to revive the Confucianism in that regard. If as a scholar, you can study the early Confucianism, who was a great teacher, who was a very enlightened person, who has a lot of moral profound teachings that will continue to be in the part of a Chinese culture. As long as you speak Chinese, mm-hmm. you're not going to go away from that. Mm-hmm. But as a political ideology, the Confucianism was being used by the later dynasties for 1,000 years as a ruling dominant ideology to justify a political order, to put all the people under the ruling that in their particular place as if a family order, moral order. And that is completely, I would say, doesn't fit or match the today's basic concept of human rights and democracy. People are equal each other.
So some dangers in going back there as well. Daniel Bell, I want to get your response, but I want to turn to our callers as well. Frank is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Frank, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Nice show.
Thanks, Frank. What do you think?
What I think is, I'm from China, and I participated in 1989 Tiananmen Square movement. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, I came to this country. Now I'm a U.S. citizen. And now looking at both sides of this world here, and my view and a lot of people have similar experience with me, sort of a turn around 180 degree. Now we look at China, what we see is besides what's in the media, the negative part, we also see hundreds of millions of people being lifted out of poverty in the last 2 decades. And that's a remarkable accomplishment.
So are you saying don't be distracted by calls for democracy, just keep improving the economy? Is that possible?
I think it's very possible. My view is the Jeffersonian democracy perhaps is not a cure-all pill, and it has failed in many parts of the world. You look at the Middle East. When you have an election, you get a radical fanatics elected. When you look at the Eastern Europe, you have a chaos after election. And to a lot of Chinese people, they think maybe not to rock the boat. Maybe let's just stick with this leadership for the time being. Keep it going. It looks like it's going towards a nice direction.
And there's a voice that came out of 1989. Frank, thanks very much for that view. Let me get another caller, if I may, from Beijing, China. Jim is on the line. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
The name's actually Jameson, but
Jameson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I just want to make a couple points, and many of them are, I think, have already been covered by other individuals. But living here, I find that many people are unhappy with the government. But as a university in Sitting, China, one of the concepts was that the middle class would push for democracy here. And after living here for a number of years, I find that many people, from taxi drivers to my colleagues, are not really satisfied with the Communist Party. However, the people, especially the middle class, they have the most to lose. You know, my colleagues have apartments, they have cars, their wealth is growing, and, you know, they have children. And although they're not happy with the system, they have the most to lose. And the people who are protesting out in the countryside, the gap between the rich and the poor, they have nothing, and that's the only reason that they're protesting. But that also means that they can easily be ignored.
So in a way, the middle class that we might expect to raise the banner of political liberalization may be afraid to do just that.
Well, exactly. And if you look at Tiananmen Square, one of the things that scared the Communist Party so much about that movement was that it was an intellectual movement combining with the support of the working class. And that is what threatened the Communist Party in that movement. And in a lot of people's minds is what caused them to crush it with the force that they used.
Jameson, in Beijing, we're glad to know you're listening there, and we're glad for your call. Thank you very much for being with us. Daniel Bell, there's been a lot put on the table here. If we can look back at some of this. To begin with, your fellow guest, Xiao Chung, says, as a democracy activist, he's very skeptical of this reinvigorated embrace of Confucianism. It sounds like a whole lot of oppression too familiar in Chinese history. Could come back with it.
No, well, I mean, I agree that Confucianism has been misused throughout Chinese history. I mean, so has liberalism in Western history. You know, John Stuart Mill justified imperialism and so on. But we need to, if we're thinking of reviving Confucianism, we have to think about reviving the desirable aspects and separating those from the problematic ones. And the question is, you know, how is the political system going to look from now, or how should the political system look from now in the future? And I agree with Xiao Qiang that the political system now is not stable in the long term. So, and I also agree with him that we need to have more representation for workers and farmers. So, and I agree with him that we need, for example, a democratic lower house where those interests would be met by elected deputies. But the question is, do we want, you know, it's in a country where it's still the large majority of people have, you know, do not have substantial education, do we want that kind of house deciding issues like whether to go to war with Taiwan or the kind of macroeconomic policy we should set? I mean, those sorts of issues, we need people leaders who are more far-sighted. And the question is, how do we identify those leaders? And again, that's where I think a properly administered examination system is the right way to do it. And I think to a certain extent it exists already in other East Asian countries. I mean, in Korea and Japan, it's often the civil servants who are chosen by meritocratic means who are more powerful than elected leaders. Why not make that system more transparent and more official and more constitutional if we're thinking about something for China's future? And
Daniel Bell,
it's not just my view.
You sound very steeped in Confucianism there after your years in Hong Kong and China already. But we're listening to that because here comes China. It's big, it's powerful, it's going to make its own imprint. We're not exactly presuming in the way we might have not that long ago that American-style democracy will be the model. I want to invite one more voice into this conversation, if I may. Joining us from Boston is Jonathan Kaufman. He was Beijing bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal for 3 years, returned to the States a year ago, has been in China since off and on since the late 70s. Jonathan Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here.
Help us try and resolve this. We have democracy activist Xiaochong saying, don't put Confucius around our neck, please. We've had enough of that before the Communist Revolution. Daniel Bell saying this may be the way forward, and the Communist Party kind of liking it because, you know, they can pose as Confucian leaders. What do you see coming out of all this, Jonathan?
Well, I think the Communist Party is trying to get ahead of a very fast-moving train. I think that one of the most important factors, maybe the most important factor in China today, is the rise of the middle class. And I agree with the caller from Beijing that the middle class feels very entitled. They want to protect what they have. But one of the things that I saw when I was living in Beijing is that these middle-class folks are starting to act like middle-class folks all around the world or even in America. They're very worried about local issues. There are housing protests, for example, all the time, not just by peasants, but by middle-class apartment owners in Beijing who want to make sure they have enough parking spaces, who want to make sure they have enough green space. And the mayor of Beijing feels he has to meet these folks because they are part of his constituency. I think, you know, one of the models, which is very close to China, both geographically and politically, is what we saw happened in Taiwan, in South Korea, in the Philippines, where you have authoritarian countries that are led by very strong leaders for a long time. But as you have a growing middle class, at a certain point, people are fed up. And they either take to the streets or they demand more democracy or there's a gradual change in the system. And if you go to Shanghai these days, which is just a booming city, if you go to Beijing, if you go to all these thriving cities, it's hard to imagine 10 or 20 years from now that this growing middle class that is sending its children overseas to study, that is getting access to outside information, is going to stand for a corrupt government, an ineffective government.
But will it be a democracy, if it's that at all, that Americans would recognize, or something Confucian style, closer to Singapore, rather authoritarian for that name?
Well, I guess I'm somewhat jaded. I mean, I lived in East Germany and Germany in 1989 when the Berlin Wall fell. And if you look back at that time and remember, there was a lot of discussion about third ways and gradual transitions and ways in which we might move from communism to something else before we went to unbridled capitalism. And I think one of the things that the revolutions of 1989 taught us was that there appears to be this almost unstoppable force of free markets and democracy, imperfect as it is, that seems to gain hold of oppressed societies once they breathe some kind of freedom.
Even with Confucius standing back there 2,500 years ago?
I wouldn't worry so much about Confucius. I think what really worries people is the Cultural Revolution. We've just had some Chinese friends visiting us over the past couple of weeks. And one of the things they talk about when we talk about democracy is this fear of chaos.
Jonathan Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
We're talking this hour about the comeback of Confucius and Confucian thinking in China and what that may mean for the country's political future, for democracy. Daniel Bell is with us from Montreal. He's professor at Tsinghua University in Beijing and author of Beyond Liberal Democracy, Political Thinking for an East Asian Context. From Berkeley, California, we're joined by Xiao Chang. He's director of the Berkeley China Internet Project at UC Berkeley School of Journalism. He was exiled from China after the Tiananmen protests of 1989. Barbara's calling from Middletown, Connecticut. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I've just spent the last year on the southern coast of China, and I live in a very beautiful complex on a golf course. But right outside where I live, and riding my bicycle with friends, there are lean-tos with people living with no services, you know, no water, no heat.
Lean-tos, shacks.
Lean-tos, shacks. And I was absolutely devastated to hear a newborn baby crying. And they can see all of this beautiful development in front of them every single day. The Chinese, whatever type of government China institutes, will have to deal with these, you know, extremes in the population. I just think that China has a very large undertaking ahead of them.
Barbara, do you think democracy would help close that gap, or would it be the fuse that lets it explode?
Gosh, you know, that's... It would be wonderful to say that it could, but as they said before on the program, the Chinese have a different view of democracy, and I have very often heard that they feel that the people out in the countryside haven't gotten the education to absolutely make decisions as far as in a democracy, to have a candidate that they could choose wisely.
Mm, but there's that gap in wealth that the boom has produced. Barbara, thanks for your call. Xiaocheng at Berkeley, how do you see this? I mean, we've heard the fear of chaos, which we know is always a big one, especially when there are tensions like that. You heard the Chinese caller say Jeffersonian democracy is not the cure-all here. You heard Jonathan Kaufman say the middle class may lead this, but others saying no, they feel too embattled or afraid of what the poor countryside would bring. What do you foresee?
I think these are all valid, interesting points. And Tom, I must claim that even I am critical to use the Confucianism to justify a political oppression. I'm not fundamentally here in contrast with what Professor Bell's investigation, which is to looking into a cultural tradition to find where the future China's democracy can have a moral inspiration and base. The let's put it this way. The future of China is more like a democracy and less, but it's less as anything else, the authoritarian. But the confusion is worth putting there. Now, I want to introduce a factor which Chinese intellectuals has debated since early last century. Mm. Like, what's stopped the China became a great nation? And where are we,
right.
How we end up this place that can be invaded and beaten up by every Western power?
Those terrible centuries before the boom when China was really flat on its back, the sick man of Asia and all that.
That's right. And they after a long debate and searching, it seems like a lot of Chinese intellectuals reach to the point and realize that the traditional culture is a factor. Then we have this called May 4th movement, essentially identify democracy mm-hmm. and science as the two factors that are going to save China.
Mm-hmm.
Today, Chinese Communist Party is sort of born from that movement as well. Today, you look back at this history, I have a mixed feelings of it. I cannot say it's all the conclusion is all correct, that you can wipe out the thousand years of culture and then to completely just rebuild something from a blank state.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the goal didn't achieve. China today still doesn't have science, real science, and still doesn't have a real democracy. And particularly, democracy is far from it's there. So where we have gone this far, and where is the traditional Chinese values and culture are there, and how that fit into the future democracy? I think that's a valid question, but the question is not going to be answered by the ruling elite whose self-serving its interest is to preserve the Communist Party's monopoly of power.
Mm.
The question should come from the people themselves and intellectuals and people who can have a free space to debate in China. That's where is the question.
Daniel Bell, how do you get there? I remember back in the 80s, I was in China on the Shandong Peninsula, actually there in Chufu, the ancestral right. home of the Kong family, Confucius right. family. And already then, the Chinese government was turning this, and the Chinese Communist Party, that means, was turning this into a kind of shrine. There'd been a lot of destruction during the Cultural Revolution, as Xiaocheng says, but there was a lot of reconstruction, refurbishing. Is it possible that China, the Communist Party, turns Confucius into a figure of veneration, but uses that history and that tradition to not acknowledge the kind of changes that need to come?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they are doing that. And it's also true that many Chinese intellectuals who appeal to Confucianism, their work cannot be officially published in China. Like a very prominent one is called Jiang Qing, and he has a long book on Confucian, on political Confucianism, which was published in China. But when he discusses about political changes, that can only be published in Taiwan. And it's also, he also has a long piece on the internet. So I think there's going to be a divergence between the government's interpretation of Confucianism and what, you know, I think intellectuals who have a more serious scholarly and normative interest in Confucianism and what they say. And personally, I think, you know, we should look to the latter for inspiration.
But how do you break through then if the Communist Party would like to claim Confucius and make him a kind of a bulwark against change potentially? Do you see the change coming from within the party? Do you see, you clearly don't see it coming straight from the ballot box. Do you see it in upheaval?
Well, I think the Communist Party is not just this kind of monolithic institution. I think you have many, factions, and there's lots of discussion within the Communist Party. So how the change will come about, I'm not sure. But I think eventually there's bound to be some sort of more progressive faction, may come within the party or may come from outside, that will lead political change. I mean, but it's hard to say. I mean, and it won't happen in the near future.
Let's take a call from Grinnell, Iowa. Sarah's on the line. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. I studied abroad in Nanjing, China last semester.
Great.
Yeah, I had a couple of interesting experiences when I overheard Chinese people talking about democracy, and they thought I was American and couldn't really understand what they were saying. But I remember listening to some older gentlemen talk about democracy and sort of the way they disagreed with how Western cultures conceptualized democracy and thought of themselves as, like, global authorities on democracy. And from that, I kind of see the value of thinking about the Confucian and also maybe Taoist philosophies and how they influence democracy, and the value of that to the Chinese people of looking at democracy as something they want to pursue and seeing the East Asian roots in that. And I think that it can be done, and that it would be really great if the East Asian philosophy could influence that.
Sarah, let me ask you, if Chinese democracy emerges and if it has a Taoist Confucian flavor, do you think it will be a democracy that Americans will recognize as such, or will it look like something entirely different?
That's a good question, Tom. I think that most Western and most Americans sort of conceptualize democracy different than East Asians do. And I hope that we would recognize that. I think Americans or U.S. residents interested in the question of democracy in other places, we really have to recognize that other perspectives are really valid, and that it's true democracy can come about through other ways besides the way we impose it on other people.
Sarah, thanks very much for that observation. Xiaoqiong, how about it? We had the caller earlier saying Jeffersonian democracy is not a silver bullet for every country. Sarah spent time in China and says, maybe there can be another style there. You're a democracy activist. Do you buy that, or does that just seem as a kind of trimming to you, a sort of cutting back ambitions before the project even really begins?
The debate is in a short limit of the time and the language, so that's too general a brush. Mm-hmm. Let me just say the future China will be a democratic China, and this is coming from a democracy activist's vision, of course. But as long as it's China, the Confucianism is a part of the cultural heritage. I'm not a cultural determinist, but the cultural factor is important, and we'll recognize it's China. But also, we will all recognize it's a democracy. It's a power by the people and for the people. That, I think, is an inspiration for the Chinese people as well. As long as the ruling Chinese Communist Party let that kind of public debate, that kind of thoughts flourish in Chinese society, Chinese people will decide. Doesn't need anybody to impose anything on it. Chinese people can decide. Let's just look at Taiwan. That's a Chinese culture. Mm. Does it have a democracy? It does. Is that perfect? No. Is it cure-all? No. But it's a functional democracy that people rather to have that kind of elected government. Does it have a Confucian flavor? It does, actually. It has that examination system as well. But it's actually a really minor point. The real point is Taiwan people can vote for who ruling them, making decisions for them. They can hold them accountable, and they have free press. And that is democracy, and that's China going to be in 20 or maybe 50 years.
Let me ask you, in 1989, during the Tiananmen protests, there was famously the kind of model of the Statue of Liberty that was raised there. What about the American model of democracy today? Do you see it as inspiring followers in China, as a model for China, or not, Xiaoqiong?
I think the principle is inspiring. The principle is universal, applicable democracy is a human project rather than an American project. That does not mean the American politics is perfect. It does not mean I agree with every bit of American foreign policy. That is the world that we're working into. Even the democracy or human rights are drawn from traditionally the Western sort of liberal democratic philosophy, but the same idea of human being born equal, we are all vulnerable, can be violated by the power, but we are also that have a sense, basic sense of justice, fairness. We don't need to draw to the point of a God or Christianity to find those resources. We can find from Confucianism as well. Confucianism is one of, it's political hierarchy thinking being emphasized by the later rulers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also such a rich a teaching. You can find just about more or less everything that, that you can use today as an intellectual resource. So does Lao's teaching, the Taoist. Mm-hmm. So does the Buddhist teaching. It's a rich cultural heritage that the future China democracy can build upon that.
It's inevitable that that will be baked in the cake somewhere. Daniel Bell, what about the American model? You write about China's the widespread revulsion in China toward the Iraq War. Do you see the American democracy as attractive today to Chinese political reformers or otherwise?
Yeah, I think American style democracy is much less attractive than it used to be, and I think that's borne out by the fact that the 2004 presidential elections were broadcast on Chinese national TV without any kind of obvious bias. I think the government has less to fear, so to speak.
And those were turn-off watching those elections?
In other words, in the past, they weren't broadcast live because the government may have feared that people watching that in China may say, hey, why don't we have democracy? Mm-hmm. But I think the Iraq War really, to my mind, especially the intellectuals I speak to, played an important role in discrediting a kind of American model of democracy, which they view as a kind of imperialist model. And so that, if anything, encourages a search for an alternative, which appeals to local traditions. Mm-hmm. If I can make one comment about
please.
Taiwan,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I have many Chinese friends who call themselves liberals, but when they go to Taiwan, they're not really inspired by that model to the extent you might think. And why is that? I think one important reason is that democracy has led to a kind of ethnic polarization, and it's the Taiwanese majority which basically controls political power now. And their much of their policies now are anti-Chinese. It's called de-Sinification. For example, they're reducing the proportion of classical Chinese which is taught in schools. So it's a kind of attack on Confucianism, and
it's
attack
sort of a
on
resurgence
Chinese.
Of ethnic Taiwanese sentiment.
Right, right. And many Chinese from the mainland who go there, they view this as an attack on their identity and on their culture. And they worry about that kind of model for China.
Of course, China has, even within the mainland, many ethnic tensions that could come to the fore. Let me get one more call. Mary Lee is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary Lee. You're on the air.
Hi there. Yeah, how are you?
Very well.
I'm curious to know what position might women hold under a new political system infused with Confucian thought. I mean, it's clear that 500 B.C., the position of women, certainly within Confucian thought is everywhere else. We're in a second-class position. I was interested to know if the thinkers have thought about that.
It's a great question. Our time is short. Of course, Confucius said the wife must be absolutely devoted to her husband, and we know where that led, bound feet and all the rest. Daniel Bell, how about
it? Can I answer briefly? Yeah, I don't think we can blame Confucian for bound feet, but anyway, it started later. But Confucian, and unlike for Aristotle, said that women are the biological inferiors of men. Confucius never had anything by that, in that vein. It was more of a kind of de facto view that women's are considered to be inferior of men. But it's not part of the central values of Confucianism. So many Confucians, including female scholars, are reinterpreting the tradition to make it more friendly to women's interests. And for example, those who say that we should have an examination system to choose political leaders now, that could have the advantage of increasing the proportion of women in government. You know, there might be 50%, if not more, of representatives who would be female if we adopted this Confucian system. So I think Confucianism reinterpreted for modern society, you know, can be beneficial to women's interests. And that's not just my view. Yeah.
Mm. Move over, ballot box. We're talking here about an examination system to produce leaders. It's a fascinating glimpse of what may be down the road for China. I want to thank both of you for being with us. Xiao Cheng at Berkeley, it's been terrific having you with us today. Thanks very much for your perspective and your time.
Thank you for having me.
And Daniel Bell, professor of political philosophy and ethics at Tsinghua University in Beijing, author of Beyond Liberal Democracy. Professor Bell, thanks very much for joining us.
And thanks a lot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.